This episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast is brought to you by Zero Bounce, an email validation system that integrates with all the major ESPs to make sure, hey, your mail doesn't bounce. Check it out at zerobounce.net. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is John Chance, and my guest today is Mark Manson. He is a speaker and a blogger at markmanson.net and the author of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck and the new book, Everything is Fucked, a book about hope. So having thrown my PG rating out the window, I want to welcome you, Mark.
It's good to be here, John.
So there is a Mark Twain quote that I love. When I quote people, I end up paraphrasing. I never get them right. But he advised writers to, every time they were tempted to use the word really or very, to substitute the word damn, because your editor would strike it out and your writing would be so much stronger. But not so much anymore, huh?
Apparently not.
I like to think of these more as concepts than words, but I was walking by the use of this language anyway. So I was walking by an airport bookstore the other day, and there's an entire section now that I think maybe you started, of people using F with some variation of asterisk. With all the issues going on in the world now, I mean, is cursing sort of become trifling?
I guess so. I mean, honestly, I'm kind of fascinated by it too. Clearly I've created kind of a brand, and a bunch of people are jumping into it and kind of copying it. But it's there seems to be something about vulgarity that, like, the shock value in it or the emotional charge in it that people are getting really excited about for whatever reason.
Yeah. Well, it might have something to do with some sales that you've accomplished as well. Last time I looked, and I'm sure you have a more accurate, but I think I saw somewhere 8 million plus copies of The Subtle Art. Do you have any sense of why that book exploded?
I think it's a combination of things. I definitely think it's part of it's the title. It definitely grabs your attention. But I also think, you know, I sometimes call my brand of self-help, I call it like a pessimistic self-help. Like it's a personal development that is less about like, oh, we can achieve anything, and it's more just like, humans suck, let's try to suck a little bit less. And I think there's something about the last few years that I think people are just feeling incredibly pessimistic, and there's a cultural moment that's happening where we're kind of becoming very aware of our own pessimism. And so for whatever reason, my style of writing, my titles, everything, it's really catching that wave right now.
Yeah. And for those who have the handful of people who have not read any of Mark's work, you're very funny. You tell great stories that are very engaging. And so it's actually very easy to read. But what I enjoy the most is, you know, you're reading along, and then you just like kind of zing us. And, you know, and it's a little bit, it's like in this newest book, the How to Start Your Own Religion. I mean, I was like, wait a minute, What? Is that? I wasn't sure if you were kidding or not for a while, you know, and that's kind of what I love about your style of writing. But I've got a really hard question for you.
Sure.
Not everybody sells 8 million books. What has that done to your life?
Well, it's made my bank account a lot bigger. It's funny. I was on another podcast recently, and they were like, wow, man. So what? Tell us, what'd you go out and buy? And I was like, I bought a Nintendo.
Well, here's the reason I asked that. Obviously, it swelled your bank account, but I don't get the sense that you're a person that necessarily seeks fame, and seek it or not, you've got it.
Yes. Yeah, it's funny. I don't think it's changed my life a whole lot. I tell people that I think being a famous author is the perfect mix, because your work is widely known and appreciated, but people don't really recognize you on the street, or, you know, if you go into a restaurant or anything. So you don't, you don't really get your privacy invaded a whole lot. So it's kind of, I wish I could give you a really exciting answer, but I don't think it's affected that much.
Yeah. So you mentioned the last couple of years seems like it's been a rough patch. I think every generation probably thinks theirs has been the worst time in history. do you find that to be true? I mean, you look at some of the divides going on, particularly in the United States right now, and I feel like they're historically bad. But
yeah.
Do you think that – I know you're a avid researcher. Do you think that that's the case?
I do think you're right. Every generation does – I mean, because every generation, whatever problems face that generation are completely new and unexplored. And so there's a little bit of, I think, a sense of specialness that comes with each generation. What is interesting about today is that the level of pessimism, or I guess just kind of hysteria that's going on, is not relative to how well we're doing economically. You know, our economies are booming. We're safe. We're not at war. We're not being bombed by anybody. There's not riots in the streets. Usually the type of pessimism that we see right now is accompanied by some sort of like massive tumultuous thing that's going on. But for whatever reason, today it's not. And so I just thought that was really peculiar. And that was kind of one of the starting points of the new book. It's like, why, basically, like, if everything's awesome, like, why are we so upset all the time?
So how does admitting we're all going to die let us live a better life?
I think, you know, facing one's mortality is a big principle in my work. And it's one thing I'm constantly trying to make the reader more aware of, I guess, their own insignificance. And I think it's, while it's kind of a downer, I think it has a very liberating effect in that it's only by thinking about one's own death that we're able to really get good perspective on what's important in our life. You know, if I start asking myself questions like, well, if this is the last year I'm alive, would I still be doing the same thing I'm doing? That presents a lot of clarity for the decisions that I'm making, and helps us kind of avoid traps and falling into habits that, you know, we wouldn't be happy we had in the long run.
There's some, Viktor Frankl, certainly you have a a story about Auschwitz in the book, and Viktor Frankl was in Auschwitz. Elie Wiesel,
yes,
was in Auschwitz, and I think, I can't remember which one of these said this, but the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. Hope is in the title, yeah, of the book, and you talk about the opposite of happiness is hopelessness. So how do we wrestle with that?
I wrote a book about hope because, you know, I think, again, coming back to kind of this pessimism that's pervading everything today, I wanted to kind of investigate what it is about, what is it about modern life that is making it so difficult to have a clear vision of where we want to go in the future. You know, I think happiness gets discussed a lot and we all want to feel good and that's great and everything. But really, it's at the end of the day, we need to have some sort of hope for something greater, for that happiness to ever emerge. And if we're not able to kind of construct that vision of something greater for ourselves, then we just end up in despair. And so it's, if we're angry or we're sad or we're anxious or upset or something, you know, that at least implies that there's hope of something greater. But if we just feel hopeless, then that implies that there's no vision for any sort of improvement.
I believe at least that, you know, a lot of people have hope when they feel they're in control of their situation. You basically tell us that self-control is an illusion and that we all pretty much just have to accept our fate. Maybe that's maybe I'm paraphrasing, but I read that.
Well, it's not that we don't have any control over ourselves. It's that so first of all, I agree with you that a lot of hope is rooted in a feeling that we have control over our fate. The point, chapter two is called Self-Control is an Illusion. The point of that chapter title is that we actually have far less control than we think we do. And we perceive ourselves to have total control over our lives. But, you know, anybody who's tried to start using their gym membership or, you know, maybe like cut something out of their diet quickly finds out that you have less control over your behavior than you typically would like to admit. And so the whole chapter kind of simply discusses why don't we do the things we know we should do? Why do we seem to have such a difficult time acting on all of the stuff that we want for our lives, that we know is good for our lives, but just for some reason, you know, we can't peel ourselves off the couch or whatever. And it turns out, you know, our minds are kind of a messy place. There's a little bit of an art to getting ourselves, to act the way that we would prefer ourselves to.
You know, email is still a very important marketing channel, but it's gotten harder to get in the inbox, even of people that want your email. Zero Bounce is an email verification system that will validate your opt-ins. Check them out at zerobounce.net. They integrate with all of the major services that you might be using already, like MailChimp or HubSpot. Check them out at zerobounce.net. My favorite part of that chapter is that you told a little story about Tom Waits, one of my favorite singer-songwriters. You know, old 55 changed my life.
I love Tom.
So one of the things that I see frequently, particularly, you know, you get to a certain, like you're not living on the streets. You know, you've got a nice job. You've got a nice house. You've got a nice car. I mean, we go out of our way to make sure that we don't do anything that's uncomfortable. I mean, yeah. A lot of people. Anyway. And you talk quite a bit about not necessarily the need to suffer, but the benefit of suffering. You want to unpack that a little?
Yeah, I think in this discussion of why we seem to be so hopeless, pessimistic today, I spend a couple chapters talking about comfort and talking about pleasure and avoiding pain. And essentially the short version is that I come to the conclusion that, you know, the same way we need to, like our muscles need to be stressed and strained a little bit on a regular basis to grow and improve and maintain health, I think our emotional and our psychological muscles, so to speak, need a certain regular amount of stress and strain to also remain healthy and robust. And my fear is that so much of the 21st century world is built around convenience and immediacy and instant gratification, that we're not getting those reps, you know, where our part of our mental health is essentially just atrophying from lack of regular exertion.
Yeah, I read somewhere, I can't remember actually who the author was, but and there may be some physiological benefit to this, but he talked about taking a cold shower in the morning. And the benefit of it was that you were going to suffer some right off the beginning of the day, and that was going to sort of then set the benchmark for the whole day. Again, there may be some actual physiological benefits too, but he was talking more mental.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said. I think the same way, you know, like 50 years ago, we discovered, you know, nutritional science started to figure out like, oh, hey, you can't eat cupcakes every day, like that's bad for you. It's I think we're starting to discover just in the last few years that some mental habits that we have, whether it's phone usage or social media or, you know, where we get our information, has kind of the same effect on us mentally. And so I think there needs to be kind of an informational diet in terms of making sure that we're challenging ourselves, challenging ourselves intellectually, but also challenging our own beliefs, you know, challenging a lot of our assumptions about our relationships in the world and things like that. And that we need that to a certain degree to maintain a healthy and balanced psychological worldview.
Yeah, I wonder to what degree we can blame mobile devices and social media for people being so freaked out lately.
I think, you know, this is a hot topic right now. And it's funny because there's a lot of data that shows a lot of really scary stuff. And then there's a lot of data that shows a bunch of nothing. And the jury's kind of out. But my sense is that, you know, social media is probably only really bad in very large doses or for very young people. Though that seems to be the most clear pattern amongst the data on social media. Interestingly, I think the smartphone thing might actually be a bigger culprit here. I think it's the constant instant access to everything you want that actually, you know, creates more psychological issues and emotional issues than necessarily Facebook.
I remember when I was growing up, you know, I'd like all kids, "Mom, I'm bored." And she used to say, "Well, good, you should be. You know, yeah. you need to be. It's healthy." But, you know, now we just can't allow ourselves that moment of boredom, can we?
Yeah, and there seems to be, you know, with that unwillingness to be bored a little bit, there also comes this kind of lack of attention, lack of focus, and also this, you know, this, I think it causes us to be a little bit more emotionally volatile than we would be otherwise.
I am a big fan of Thoreau's writing, and I love this quote from, I'm not sure actually where it appeared, but we ignore the God inside us in an effort to venerate the God that would not exist without us. You take on religion a little bit, or at least the organized fashion of religion as a little bit of a, I don't know what, if you want to say enemy, but as something that also kind of freaks people out.
Yeah, it's funny. So there's a chapter on, you can't really write a book about hope without writing about religion. And so I've avoided touching religion for pretty much my whole career. But I felt like this book was finally the place to do it. I have a couple points about religion. You know, one, first of all, I'm an atheist, but I'm not necessarily, I definitely am not super critical of like traditional religions themselves. I think there's a lot, I understand why people believe in them and a lot of the benefits and meaning that they get from them. For me, the points I wanted to make with that chapter is, one, I don't think it's actually kind of the opposite of atheism, which is that I don't really think it's possible for us to not behave religiously to some extent. You know, even if you don't worship like a traditional God, or go to church, you're still buying into certain groups and belief systems, largely on faith that they are important, they matter, and that they're going to make the future better. They're, you know, they provide hope for you. And anytime you buy into kind of this set of belief systems or set of constructs on faith, you end up creating alliances with other people with who share those values, and then also defending those beliefs against other people. And so I cast a very wide net in terms of like how I define religion. You know, something as simple like something, political parties, sports teams, you know, even being a fan of a TV series, like these can all be religious experiences, in that there's a mythology that we were putting our hopes in, and then we are organizing ourselves around those hopes together and finding meaning in them. And, you know, this is it's a fundamental human behavior. We all do it. But as with every human behavior, it has a lot of benefits, but it also has a lot of costs. And so a lot of people just over the years, I'm always being emailed by very religious people saying like, well, you know, X book that defines my whole religion, like said a bunch of this stuff before you did, you know? And it, my approach has always been like, well, of course it does, you know, because this is just how the human mind works. And the reason these religions have been around so long is that they manage to help orient people very well towards the world. So it's a little bit of a trippy chapter, and I've definitely lost some readers over it, but I've been prepared to make that sacrifice.
I thought we were just going to lose the Catholics, but now we're going to lose Game of Thrones fans and the New England Patriots fans all in one shot, one chapter. Great. So
well, we're probably better off without them.
So the political messages today seem to be everything is screwed up and it's not your fault, it's them. And I think that yeah. mentality seems to be at the root in some ways of all this sort of discontent.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of my big goals with this book, because one of the things that surprised me and made me very happy about the success of Subtle Art was that I have very large fan bases on both sides of the political spectrum. And especially, you know, in 2019, there are not many people who are able to speak to both sides without being skewered in some way. And so I very consciously wrote this book to kind of speak up to both sides at once and say, hey, it's not quote unquote them that are causing the problems. It's us. Like we are the problem. Like there's nothing special about that person you hate or that person you hate. It's us. This is a cultural issue, and we have to come together to solve it.
The final chapter, you talk about AI, and I think you even go as far as calling it the final religion. When I read that, you know, I'm into technology. I like to know the new kind of things going on. But the further I got into that chapter, I couldn't decide if I was hopeful or if that actually caused despair, the idea of that.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell really where you were coming down on that.
I think I'm in a very weird spot with AI. I think most people, there are people who are, I guess, terrified of AI, who think that AI is going to kind of overthrow the world order and we may not make it out alive. And then there are kind of AI utopists who think that AI is gonna, you know, we're gonna merge with the AI and everything's gonna be amazing and we're gonna solve all of our problems. And I think the reason I called it the final religion is because essentially all of these other issues that we struggle with today on all these other places that we try to find meaning, once general intelligence surpasses human intelligence, it's going to render all these other questions either obsolete or it will advance them so quickly that we're not going to be able to keep up. And so I felt like it was a natural endpoint. As much as it's blindsided a lot of readers, I felt like it was a very natural endpoint for the book. And I personally think, you know, AI is probably going to render us obsolete, but I find that to be very hopeful because for one, I believe morality is very much based in rationality. I think it's the best aspects of ourselves come when we are able to sit down and think and be compassionate. And if the AI surpasses us in intelligence, then it's probably going to surpass us in its understanding of morality as well. One of the points I make in the book is like, look, like we're the ones who commit genocide. We're the ones who, you know, beat and abuse and enslave each other. You know, we don't really, in terms of an ethical argument about AI, like we don't really have a leg to stand on. And it's, if this greater force comes along that we're no longer able to comprehend, and they start organizing a world in which a lot of these religious conflicts and us versus them dichotomies fall away, then I think that that's better for everybody, even if we're not the ones in charge anymore. So I'm kind of like this misanthropic AI supporter.
I mean, there are those that would argue that it could actually amplify those things that you talked about as opposed to making them go away. But I mean, I guess that's the challenge with any technology.
It is. It could amplify. I mean, it could amplify up to a degree. And then I think once it surpasses us, you know, maybe it comes back on the other side. But the other thing I wanted to explore in that chapter that I haven't really seen talked about anywhere is that, you know, traditional religion emerges from mystery. You know, it's when humans don't understand something, we come up with a lot of, I guess, supernatural explanations. You know, it's like, if you dance this way, then it's going to rain next week. And so I really enjoyed exploring this idea of, like, once AI takes over, like, we're not going to have any idea what the hell is happening anymore. You know, cars are going to show up and drive us somewhere and drop us off in a building. There's going to be people there, and we're not going to know why any of this stuff is happening. And so it's in a kind of weird irony, we might start returning to a lot of this kind of religious behavior of like cavemen and stuff. It's like, oh, well, if you wear this shirt, the AI gods will look, put favor on you, and they'll take care of your family. So, you know, be sure to say this when the car comes. I don't know. For some reason, I think it's hilarious, but a lot of people have emailed me and been like, dude, that is dark.
Yeah, I didn't find it dark. I think what you just, the word you said, mysterious, it just really kind of shows
yes.
that it could be a different world, is unsettling to some.
I think it will be. You know, all this joking and you know, the religious talk aside, I think it really is going to be a different world. And I think it's going to be different in such a way that we can't really comprehend what the issues and divisions are going to be when it comes.
So Mark's books can be found pretty much anywhere. In fact, I have a this is a personal question. Many of my listeners may not care about this, but I noticed your recent book, Harper brought it back out in paperback and hardcover at the same time. Was there any thought in that?
Well, they're doing this thing. It drives me crazy, man. So they do these things called Harper Lux, and it's basically large print editions. They're paperback, but they're large print editions. So it's like 500 pages. The fonts are blown up really big for people with like poor eyesight. Amazon keeps categorizing them as paperback, even though they're like these special editions for people with bad eyesight. And so people keep buying them thinking that they're the paperback, and then they show up and they're these big fat, like 600 page books with giant text.
I've got another funny story for you on, my first book, published 2007 by Thomas Nelson, who is now owned by Harper, or they're all owned by each same company probably. But my first book, they had very few edits, but one of them is they wanted me to take the word crap out of the text. So I thought you would enjoy that.
Wow. How far we have come.
So, Mark, it was a pleasure meeting you in this format and learning your thoughts and deeper thoughts on your writing. And people check out Mark's work. As I said, the books will be sold pretty much anywhere you can buy a book. And you might want to follow markmanson.net. Any other places you want to invite people?
No, that's it.
I did it all. All right. Awesome. Mark, thanks so much. Hopefully we'll run into you out there on the road sometime.
All right. Thanks, John.